Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, December 7, 2014, the first show in the last month of this year. We appreciate your joining us tonight as we continue to create lifeboats of sanity and community in a mad and alienating world. One of the reasons our world has become mad and alienating is that industrial growth society itself is completely alienated from nature. Now, we could trace this back to the decline of the hunter-gatherer living style and people becoming sedentary in agricultural societies. We can also notice the notion inherent in the Judeo-Christian tradition that nature is evil and needs to be subdued. And of course, this notion became sacrosanct in the Enlightenment as Cartesian dualism and the perception of the universe as a machine paved the way for the Industrial Revolution. All along the way, though, humans became more estranged from nature and their animal essence. In this time of global crisis, many people are beginning to feel and taste, on a bone marrow level, the loss of their connection with nature and the more-than-human world. And they're beginning to discover how healing it is to become re-enchanted with the natural world. Our guest tonight is one of the world's leading animal experts and activists, Mark Beckoff, who is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, is here with us, and he's the co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society, and a former Guggenheim Fellow. He lectures internationally on animal behavior, cognitive ethology, which is the study of animal minds, and behavioral ecology, and writes a science column about animal emotion for Psychology Today. Mark is also the author of Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence, a book that invites readers to do the essential work of becoming re-enchanted with the world, acting from the inside out and dissolving false boundaries to truly connect with both nature and themselves. His article, Rewilding, A Cultural Meme for Rehabilitating Our Hearts, was published in Psychology Today in October of this year. And a few weeks later, Psychology Today published another article by Mark entitled, Take a Walk on the Rewild Side. Mark is a vegan. He's also a patron of the Captive Animals Protection Society, a charity campaigning against the exotic pet trade and the use of non-human animals in circuses and zoos. In May 2010, he argued in an article for the Greater Good Science Center, which was entitled Expanding Our Compassionate Footprint, that human beings need to abandon human exceptionalism. He stated, quote, "Research on animal morality is blossoming, and if we can break free of theoretical prejudices, we may come to better understand ourselves and the other animals with whom we share this planet." You can follow Mark's works and writings at markbeckoff.com, that's spelled markbeckoff.com. I welcome to the Lifeboat Hour a fellow resident of my hometown, Boulder, Colorado, and one of the planet's great champions for animals and the animal in each of us. Mark Beckoff, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you, Carol, for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah. Well, Mark, you know, rewilding is one of your favorite terms and begins the title of your latest book. So please explain, first of all, what you mean by the term, and then please explain what you call the 8 P's of rewilding.
Yeah. I mean, basically, rewilding really says what I mean is we need to rewild ourselves because of the unwilding that basically occurs, you know, very early in life during education, because schools pull kids off of, playgrounds, make them sit in front of, computers, for example. We unwild because of our busy lifestyles. I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but, a lot of people are just jammed and they just keep going and going. And one way I always say you can rewild is that familiar phrase, stop to smell the roses.
Yeah.
So really, rewild means to make wild again, if you will, to return to sort of a natural curiosity and interaction with nature. There's this phenomenon called biophilia that a lot of people ascribe to that says that we have a very strong and innate attraction to other nature. And we just get pulled away from it, like I said, because of lifestyles and because we just get too busy and other things become more important.
And so what are the 8 P's then of rewilding?
Well, there's 8 of them, and I've actually added 2 because I always like to say that ideas and books are works in progress. They're being proactive, positive, persistent, patient, peaceful, practical, powerful, and passionate. And I've added 2, being playful and being present. So being proactive means we have to stop on this putting out the fire mentality. It really makes me bristle when people say, oh, the world is resilient and we can keep abusing the world and wounding it. No, the world is tired and it doesn't have a lot more rebound, if you will, to it. Being positive, concentrating on what works, not what doesn't work. There's a lot of really good things happening out there. I mean, there's a lot of bad things, but there's a lot of good things, and we need to embrace them. Being persistent and patient, meaning stick to your agenda, if you will, and don't get sidetracked. Being patient means you're not going to see a gold star on your head tomorrow, and you may not see the fruits of your labor in your lifetime, but you got to really believe that you're doing something. Being peaceful means being at peace with yourself. First of all, you have to be at peace with yourself. Second of all, being peaceful, especially with people with whom you disagree. It's perfectly okay to disagree or to agree to disagree and move on. You don't get anywhere by yelling at people. I always say you talk with them, not at them or to them. Being practical, take on things that you really can handle. You don't have to be a multimillionaire to make a difference. Small things can count. I always like to say, one of the practical aspects would be act locally and think globally. Be powerful. Really realize that, when you're fighting for the good and you're fighting for compassion and empathy and kindness and love, you're not the radical. I mean, I know people think that people who, have these points of view are the radicals, but we're not. So there's a lot of power in what I think is being right. Being passionate, once again, plays into a lot of these, just really embracing what you really want to do and doing it from your heart. And the last 2, being playful. A lot of activists suffer from secondary trauma. They identify with the animals or the humans with whom they work, and they burn out. And so one of the ways not to burn out is be playful. Don't take yourself too seriously all the time. Relax. And being present. And being present, once again, plays back to what I've been talking about, is really being passionate and persistent and, really going for it, if you will. So the 8 P's have morphed into the 10 P's.
Well, I like them very much.
Or the green peas.
It sounds like a really good recipe for being alive and conscious on this planet.
Yeah. That's a really good way to put it. I mean, we've got a beautiful planet. We've got a magnificent world. And we've got wonderful people who are working really hard to keep what we have. And so you just have to, I hate to use the sort of commercials, just do it, but just go for it. And
absolutely,
like I said, you know, we know compassion begets compassion, violence begets violence. And right. So what I look at is rewilding as a cultural meme that will travel across the world, because we will set an example for other people, and then, you know, they will pick it up, and then they will share it, and it will spread. And it's amazing how fast, if you will, good things and compassion can spread.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've beautifully explained the concept of rewilding, but how do we incorporate it, Mark, into our daily lives?
Well, small things count, like I said. And one of the things, some examples, I mean, I live in beautiful Boulder, and you know it's beautiful.
Yep.
But when I go to New York City, once I was in New York City, and I stopped and looked at squirrels, and these kids came over, and they were curious, and one of them said, "What are you doing, mister?" I said, "I'm watching the squirrels." And Mom said, "Oh, they're just squirrels. We see them every day." And I said, "No, you know," I said, "really, can you just give me a minute?" Well, within less than a minute, I had these kids watching squirrels play, understanding that they're social animals, that they're in the same family. You know, their rodent says rats. Seriously, these kids were enthralled. I think honestly, it was the best time they've had. Walking through Central Park with Mom in their lives, then looking at flowers, standing and looking at waterways, just peering outside. I'm talking to you now. I'm looking at the beautiful Flatirons of Colorado, Boulder, Colorado. And, I mean, it warms me. So it's so easy to do, you know, take a walk, volunteer at your local shelter. The thing about rewilding, Carol, that I think is really critical is it doesn't only focus on non-humans. Human animals are part of the equation, because it's absolutely naive to think we're going to make any progress saving non-humans and their homes if we don't incorporate humans as stakeholders.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we happen to be pre-recording this show on a beautiful day, a gorgeous day, as both of us look out at the Flatirons of Colorado.
Oh, yes, that's right. I remember you're here. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like I always say, you know, you don't have to found a movement. You don't have to put $1 million into something. You can do something that really helps the world. And one of the other messages about rewilding is, you know, dealing with the secondary trauma is taking care of yourself. I mean, in the book, I mentioned some ways I do it, but I always say I work hard, I rest hard, and I play hard, and I walk away from my brain. I'm known for reading terrible spy novels and watching horrible movies. Mm-hmm. But I really mean that. I at the end of the day or during the day, I just need a break from all I'm doing, and that's the way I do it. My friend Bruce Gottlieb, who's a psychologist in Boulder, says what you do is you walk away from your cortex and you just take a break.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well, you know, you speak of becoming re-enchanted with nature, which is a term I love because I frequently speak of falling back in love with the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we become re-enchanted with nature? And as you say, even if we live in Manhattan.
Well, it would be the way of, you know, watching squirrels, watching birds, appreciating the dogs who walk down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan or other cities, focusing on flowers, focusing on trees. Very, very simple things. One is just being outside. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nothing, you know, there's no rocket science to what I'm going to say now, but for a lot of people, just being outside is really what makes their day. You have, you know, think about it. I'm sure you're part of this group too. If I'm having a bad day and I just need a break, I go outside and I just stand outside. Sometimes I'll take a walk. So that's another way. And the simplicity of rewilding is what astounds a lot of people. Just go outside, take a deep, you know, breath of fresh air and feel it go through your body, or, you know, watch crows or ravens or other birds, you know, alighting on the breeze and playing.
Right.
It's easy to do. It's not, you know, some people go, oh, I can't afford to go to Africa to see elephants, or I can't afford, you know, to take a safari. You don't have to. You can,
right.
You can just do it on your own. And that's the beautiful thing about it, is that rewilding is a personal, deeply personal transformation. So it doesn't have to, it doesn't have to deal with anybody else as well.
Yeah, and you know, when I first moved to Boulder 5 years ago, and I'm an outdoor person, but I could not believe all of the ways in which this community has made being outdoors really easy. And so many people in the community want to be outdoors. And we have a huge park here, the Houston Park, which is for people and dogs. It's beautifully covered with grass and surrounded with lush trees. And frequently I will take my chair and just go over there and sit and just drink it in. And I take my dog there almost every day. Mm-hmm. So just that sort of simple, you know, being outdoors. I mean, I would go crazy if I had to be indoors all day, and many, many people do.
Right. I mean, going to dog parks is a wonderful way. Exactly. Not only do you get to watch dogs having fun, but you talk with people who are, you know, there. You can learn about the dogs, and you can just hang out and take it easy. Really, like I said, the recipe for rewilding is nothing complex. People make more out of it than they need to, but they also need to pay attention to the feelings that are involved when you're out in nature, you know.
Yes.
And out in nature can be interpreted in, you know, many different ways, but you really need to pay attention to how good it feels and using that to motivate you to do more.
Well, two human beings here, Mark and I, have been carrying on this lovely conversation about rewilding and becoming reenchanted with nature, but I think we need more than just human voices in this conversation. Let's listen to 3 minutes of conversation from our whale and seagull relatives.
Mmm.
That was a clip of whales and seagulls singing, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and my guest tonight is Professor Emeritus Mark Beckoff, who lives here in Boulder, Colorado, where I also live. I just have to say that when I hear those whales, it just gets me right in my heart. It just really does. One of the things that we both love about Boulder is that it's right here up against the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And I don't know about you, Mark, but I see deer almost every day, and I'm only about 10 minutes from being deeply immersed in natural solitude whenever I want to be. I'm assuming you share that same love for our town, yes?
Oh, absolutely. I am. I consider myself blessed to live here. I really do.
Yeah, me too.
I do.
Me too.
Yeah.
And so,
Oh, I was just smiling. I realized.
Well, I heard you all the way across town.
Yeah, no, it was lovely.
So on this show, we deal with the global crisis every week in some way. And with you, Mark, I share the notion and the experience that when we face the global crisis consciously, it can make our lives more meaningful and satisfying if we're willing to really do that consciously. And in fact, last year I published my book, Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times, in which I emphasized how much more alive and purposeful we feel when we face the global crises with intention. I'd love it if you'd say more about this.
Tell me a little bit more of what you mean by that, if it's okay.
Well, somewhere in your writings, I'm not sure exactly where I saw it, but you talked about facing the global crisis consciously or with intention, not putting our heads in the sand. You also talked about something else I want to ask you about, which is not getting overwhelmed. But, you know, if you could just say a little bit more about how you perhaps face the global crisis intentionally.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, in some ways, that's kind of part of the that's kind of part of the, you know, the 10 P's now, but the way I face it is every day I try to do something positive. Every day I mean, it's my job, so I understand that I'm different from, you know, a lot of people, but, you know, my job is to stay abreast of what's happening and write about it and do something about it. So I pay a lot of attention to emails that come in, headlines in newspapers that tell me about, you know, things that are actually going on. And I do it really, when you say with intention, I guess I do it very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I pay attention, you know, to the science behind it. I pay attention to what people are thinking and try to blend in, you know, if you will, science and I'm just trying to think of how to say it, you know, blend in science with emotion and with feeling.
Yes, yes. That's very much my work. And, it's so challenging sometimes in this culture to do that and to see why, you know, help people see why that's important is the integration of science and emotions or spirituality as well.
I mean, I'm going to say exactly. I mean, for me, it's like a deeply internal, personal process. And I do it every day. That's what I love about it. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
It just works for me to just, you know, do it every single day and basically, you know, just rewild to my heart's content.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And on the other hand, I know that you've talked a little bit about people can become overwhelmed if they face the crisis too fast or they try to do it alone and without support. So what are some suggestions that you have for not getting overwhelmed?
I rest hard when I get done working and I play hard. Mm-hmm. I really step away from my brain. It's not like I act as if nothing's happening, but more I act knowing, you know, I do that knowing that I'm going to burn out. You know, you can't run a car on empty. You can't run your body on empty.
No.
And I think part of what keeps me going is my optimism. I mean, believe me, I always say to people, I wouldn't have a job if all the horrible things didn't happen. But the fact of the matter is there's so many people around the world doing positive things that just really works for me.
Well, you know, I have a life coaching practice, and I talk with people all over the world all the time who are dealing with the global crisis, and many have gotten overwhelmed, or they're just now learning how to manage dealing with it. And one of the things I just want to mention here, because I do this every week during the time that our webinar is running. I'm running a webinar right now with some amazing guest speakers, and the title of it is Relationships in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse. And last night we had a fabulous guest, Francis Weller, who's been on this show a couple of times this year, talking about grief. And the last two shows of this webinar series are going to really focus on awe and inspiration and beauty. And so I'd just like to mention again that you can find out all about this webinar by going to synccast.net, and there you can get information and you can register for all of the sessions and get the recordings that you've missed, or you can register for a single session. But it is a wonderful way to connect with other people, to be with people of a like heart and mind, and ask questions of these amazing guests, and really balance in your own heart and body and mind, you know, the other side of the horrible crises and the horrible things that we are facing, and really fill yourself with this sense of community.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's right. I mean, that's the way I do it, in the sense of building, building a network in your community. Very,
yes.
Very important, because rewilding, like I said, if you view it as a meme, it's going to be a global community effort.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to take a couple of minutes now to go back to our animal relatives and listen to just two minutes of rainforest animal sounds, after which we will return to the conversation with Mark. Thank you, animal friends. Welcome back, everyone, to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm talking tonight with Mark Beckoff, animal expert and activist. Mark, I'm sure that some of our listeners will want to contact you, so what's the best way to do that? And please tell us again the full title of your rewilding book.
Well, my book is called Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence. And the best way to find me is at my homepage, markbekoff.com, markbekoff.com.
Great. I want to ask you this question. I don't have the full details on it, but it has been in the news recently. A couple of weeks ago, I was dumbfounded by the story that I first read in the UK's newspaper, The Daily Mail, that had the headline, Tanzania orders 40,000 Maasai tribesmen to leave their homeland after going back on their promise not to turn their land into a hunting ground for Dubai royal family. So, you know, I don't know the details about what Tanzania actually did. The brutality here toward animals, if this is true, and the exploitation of the Maasai are jaw-dropping. We're looking at the extinction of species like elephants and rhinoceros that could be gone within a few years. Would you comment on this?
I would love to, but I don't know enough about it. I mean, If I understood it right, it's asking them to leave to turn an area into a hunting ground, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's reprehensible. I mean, I'm not sure I could say any more. I mean, honestly, right. it's reprehensible. It's reprehensible to ask people to leave their homes. And number two, you know, it's reprehensible to think of all the killing and the blood that's going to be shed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know. It's horrible. Yeah.
You know, a question just came to me as we were talking, that just came in off the top. You know, this has been a week or 2 weeks of, you know, in the news across our country, tremendous racial conflict and protest and upheaval. And I was just thinking, you know, I wonder what having these close, intimate relationships with animals, what kind of difference that might make in our relationships between different cultures, between different ethnic groups. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, once again, I'm not an expert in ethnography nor, you know, cultural anthropology, but I think, and I argue in the book, and there are data, so I mean, I argue the point, but there are data that show that when you're feeling good about yourself, you're also feeling good about the world at large. You know, like I said, you know, compassion and, you know, these warm feelings beget compassion and these warm feelings. And I think if people took the time to re-enchant themselves with nature, to reconnect, they would feel better, and that would spill over into human-human interactions. I mean, the other thing I point out in the book, and I think once again it's pretty clear, is most of the world, I mean, I would wager 99% of the world or more is, you know, are basically nice, kind, generous, compassionate, empathic people. Mm-hmm. And I know that, you know, people can argue this, but there are some new books out that show that cross-culturally, humans are a lot nicer and a lot more compassionate and a lot more empathic than we give them credit for. And, you know, I think it's clear, you know, most people I know, you know, are against war. Most people are, or everyone I know is repulsed by this situation of asking Maasai to leave their home. And so I think what we need is this rewilding revolution will maybe sort of a backdoor into making people realize that we don't really need war to get our, if you will, you know, our feelings across.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I was just thinking that, like, when we can go to places where we interact with animals, you know, even though we are animals, you know, there are a lot of animals that are really different from us. Mm-hmm. And if we can develop this kind of relationship with animals where we appreciate the differences, you know, maybe that would help us appreciate the differences in other humans. I don't know. Just a thought.
No, I think you're right. And I think there's been studies that, I don't think there's any study that's directly spoken to that question, but there are studies from which you can make the inference that a lot of the discrimination based on in-group, you know, I guess psychologists, sociologists call it in-group and out-group membership, a lot of that really does spill over The way we view, you know, not when I say we, I don't mean you and I, but the way humans might view members of other races, other cultures as outgroup, the other sometimes is
right.
The term. It's the same way that we look at non-human animals as the other. And so I think when you break down the barriers among human societies, you also, when you break down the barrier between us and other animals, you will also work to break down the barriers across human cultures.
Yeah, I really believe that's true.
I really do feel that way, yeah.
And I'm glad to hear that there are studies on that.
Well, people generalize. You know, some people are very closed, and they're closed not only to incorporating non-humans into their lives, but incorporating strange foreign humans, you know, into their lives.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you and I have spent a lot of time in higher education, and you talk about the importance of humane education and wild play. Mm-hmm. I was an adjunct professor of history and psychology for 11 years, and one of the things that horrified me about higher education is the demise of the humanities and the priorities that are now being placed on science and technology, both of which we need. But if they aren't balanced with the humanities, we just get more and more global crises. So I'd love you to expound on this as much as you would like, on humane education and wild play.
Well, I mean, the simple message there is with wild play, I always say we let kids be the animals who they are supposed to be. And part of it's wrapped into humane education in two ways. Number one, it's humane to allow kids to be who they want to be. And number two, they will then definitely begin to enjoy nature, you know, get outside. Richard Love, who is famous for, you know, putting forth the idea of the nature deficit disorder, wrote the foreword for my book, and I was thrilled to have him do it. And, you know, his point is, there might be a disorder like nature deficit disorder, like attention deficit disorder. That might in fact be overcome, if you will, by getting kids out into nature to engage in wild, spontaneous play. They also get physical exercise and they also learn to resolve conflicts. So there's so many reasons why wild play is good. And a couple of years ago, I was at a meeting in Cardiff, Wales. And there's a group called Play Wales, and their slogan is "Better a broken bone than a broken spirit." Amen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Wild play.
Yeah, I mean,
in your work around rewilding, about acting from the inside out. What do you mean by that?
Acting from the inside out really basically means letting your feelings draw, you know, letting the pathways of compassion and coexistence, the pathways are in your body. You have a feeling in your heart. It motivates you to do something. You know, somehow, you know, the message is translated up to your brain. And then your brain sends out messages to muscles and maybe back to your heart. So what I mean by acting from the inside out is a very simple message that allow your feelings to motivate you into, you know, if you will, compassionate and peaceful action.
Right. I would like you to talk a little bit, you know, back to this question of nature deficit disorder. I feel so strongly that this is such a huge issue, even unconsciously in our culture. And, you know, I'd like you to say more about that, if you would.
Well, I don't know much more about it than it's pretty clear that being outside is a natural aspect of non-human animal childhood, if you will. And we're animals, we're mammals, so being outside would be important to us. You can play off of the notion of biophilia, which talks about our innate or inherited attraction to other nature. And once again, you know, look where kids want to go when they've got free time and you give them the choice. They're outside. I used to come home from school, have my milk and cookies, and disappear. My mother would say, "Have fun, be home by 5. I mean,
right.
I also had a talk with somebody, and I realized where they were coming from, Carol. You know, when I went to school, and maybe when you went to school, it was safe to just run around town on your own.
We were born in the same year, so yes.
Yeah, and so really, I mean, I could come home, have milk and cookies. I could go out and play in the woods across from my house. Mm-hmm. And I'm serious, not a single time did my mother say, don't take candy from strangers. Don't,
right.
You know, I mean, seriously, and people laugh about it, but it's not funny. I mean, a lot of the reason why people, kids are so restricted, they have to be dropped off at school, they have to be picked up at school, they can't go down the block and play because of there's danger lurking, if you will. So
where they go is not outside. They go to their room and get on the computer.
Right, and they play dangerous. When I say dangerous games, sometimes they engage in games that encourage them to do horrible, violent things. Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a trade-off, but I hadn't really thought about it because maybe I was lucky. You know, I grew up and I could ride my bike to school. I could say to my mom, I'm going outside now, you know, say 3:30, I'll be home at 5. I could walk down the streets. I didn't have to worry about somebody assaulting me. I'm not kidding you. And I had not thought about how that also can restrict people's, you know, what kids can do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so you talk about human exceptionalism, and you wrote about it, that humans need to abandon this. Say more about human exceptionalism and your take on it.
Well, my take is that all species are exceptional. We don't fly. We don't use ultrasound or infrasound. We don't pay taxes. I mean this. Dogs don't pay, we do pay taxes, sorry. Dogs don't pay taxes. What I really like to make of those examples is that human exceptionalism doesn't really work when it's used to place humans above and separate from other animals. And then the words that are associated with this are we're better, we're more valuable, et cetera, et cetera. That our interests should trump the interests of, you know, all other animals. And so that's what I mean. But really, when you pay attention to who other animals are, you know, it's just amazing. Bees can get depressed. Crocodiles have been shown recently to use tools, as do fish. I mean, mm-hmm. There's so much going on out there. It's amazing. And so I don't like the implication that we are exceptional and better and more valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's really a huge piece of why we are facing the global crisis that we're facing, because we have taken that position.
Oh, sure. We're arrogant. You know, I always say we overproduce, we overconsume, we leave big footprints, and we're very arrogant about who we are and what our position in the world allows us to do. And we need to cool it.
which has led to something else that you've written about, worked on, is the exotic pet trade. Can you say something about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, animal trade in general, and that involving exotic animals, is off scale. I mean, people, you know, once again, it's hard for people, maybe even in the United States or the Western, you know, countries, to appreciate the fact that people will often pack in, you know, 1,000 snakes into a suitcase. I mean, seriously, you know, or birds just crammed into a cage, birds crammed into a suitcase. It's hard for us to imagine that people actually do that. And recently, the illegal animal trade, the illegal wildlife trade, has really been tied to international terrorism. There's a lot. It's incredibly lucrative.
Mm-hmm. Right, of course. Which is why people do it.
So people do it. Hello.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there are pictures, you know, of some of that sort of stuff on Facebook. And I use Facebook a lot for my work. And, you know, I see some of these pictures of, you know, like thousands of dogs in a big, huge rope cage, you know, mm-hmm. being transported by a crane onto a ship where they're going to be slaughtered. And, you know, some of that stuff I can't even watch.
Oh, yeah.
And I know that humans need to bear witness to this misery to some extent. But, you know, I have to shut the valve off sometimes because I just can't take it.
Well, I'll tell you, to be honest, and once again, not that I wouldn't be honest, but to be honest with you, one of the ways I maintain my sanity is I rarely, if ever now, watch any videos of animal abuse. Mm-hmm. I know it occurs. So people say, could you watch this video of something that's happening on a factory farm and comment? And I'll very often say, no, I can't. But if you want me to write something based on this particular video, why don't you watch it and tell me some of the things? And I'm not
really.
So that's the way I retain my sanity. I don't mm-hmm. read books or newspapers or magazines. I've seen enough. Maybe some people, and I admit to this, maybe some people need to see more, but like I always say, I'm employed because of what's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. I know what happens on factory farms and circuses, zoos and rodeos, and in the illegal wildlife trade. I don't need any more. I'm sorry to say that. I'm not sorry to say that.
No, don't apologize, please. And thanks for validating what I said. You worked to some extent with Jane Goodall, is that correct?
Yeah, on that project? The ethics committee. I'm on the ethics committee for the Jane Goodall Institute. I wrote a book called The 10 Trusts with her back in 2002. We've written some articles together, and I'm always happy to help her along. She's an amazing woman. She's a busy woman, globetrotting here and there. And I so value her real world perspective. You know, people sometimes will say, oh, why don't you do this? Or why don't you say that? What I love about Jane's work is it embraces non-human animals and human animals and their homes, the environment. And in the best of all possible worlds, maybe she and I and you too, everybody would take a different view. But, you know, there's a real world out there. And it, like I said, if you're going to get anything done, you've got to incorporate human animals into your scheme. You just have to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you lecture internationally on cognitive ethology. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, cognitive ethology is basically the study of animal minds. You know, what's in them, what they think about, what they feel. And as an ethologist, I base a lot of my conclusions, if you will, and theories on observation, sometimes on what I call, you know, humane and really keen experiments that don't harm the animals, you know, not invasive laboratory research. And so it's really just studying what animals are thinking and what they're feeling. And as you know, and I'm sure a lot of listeners know, it's incredible what we've learned. You know, mice and rats and chickens display empathy. New Caledonian crows make and use tools that are more sophisticated than those made and used by chimpanzees. Many animals have very strong moral lives. They know what's right and wrong. The list just goes on and on. A recent one is how birds are able to assess not only the type of food that's available, but how much of it, and plan future meals so they don't run out of food. And I know, like many of my friends, when I go to a cupboard, it's often bare.
Uh-huh. Well, that brings me to the final question that I want to ask you. You are a vegan, so can you tell us about that?
Well, as a vegan, I don't eat any animals or animal products. I'm proud of it. I never would be in anyone's face about it. I think, and sometimes people get upset with me, Carol. I think being vegan is a great way to add compassion to the world and reduce the amount of pain and suffering. But it's not the only way to do this. And I'm very upfront to say I would love the world to be vegan, but there's plenty of non-vegans who do amazing things for the world. So, you know, I don't know where to go other than to say, you know, I've had arguments with some people saying, well, if people really cared about animals, they wouldn't work in zoos. And I always say, my goodness, I am so happy some of the people I know who work in zoos work there because they care about the animals.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes all the sense in the world to me.
Yeah, and rewilding really has, once again, that more pluralistic view. Like I said, I'm upfront. I wish the world were vegan. I wish zoos and circuses and rodeos and factory farms would go away. Maybe someday they will, but they're here now, and therefore we need to incorporate them into the framework in which we interact with the world. You can be anti-rodeo and zoo, for example, and work to make the lives of those animals better, as long as your goal is at some point to basically get rid of them.
Absolutely. I love it.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's the way I feel. I know wonderful people who, you know, are not vegan or vegetarian, who do amazing things for the world. And in fact, who are amazing parents who basically teach their kids just a lot about the different ways and the best ways to interact with human animals in their homes. And so somebody might say, well, wouldn't they be better if they tried to convert their kids to vegetarianism and veganism? Well, yeah, I mean, I could see where that would be, quote, better. But once again, and it's part of the 8 P's, sometimes we just are going to disagree, and I will put out the message. So as an example, I always say, with respect to food and clothing, it's who you wear and eat, not what you wear and eat. So it's who's for dinner, not what's for dinner. I gave a talk in Vienna about 2.5 years ago. I put the message out, and I go on. I don't dwell on it. I don't chastise people. I had an email that 5 people from the audience, the audience in Vienna who heard my talk, went vegetarian.
Thank you so much, Mark Beckhoff, for being with us tonight. Mark is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado. He is one of the world's leading animal experts and activists, and it has been wonderful to have this conversation with you, Mark. Thank you for being here, and thank all of you for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Carol, and thank you, listeners. Really, we all need to work together. You know, stop the bickering. We just need to work together to make the world a better place for every being and everything.
Thank you, Mark, and thank all of you. We'll see you all next week on the Lifeboat Hour.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fit. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows you really do. Everybody. God and knows you've been faithful. Give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Now or never. Everybody knows it's me or you. Everybody knows that you live forever when you've done a little line or two. Everybody knows that dealing rotten, old Black Joe is still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the plague is coming. Everybody knows it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's going to be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows.